What is going on, comic fam? It's your boy, the Bearded Comic Bro, and I am welcoming back to the show, David Pepos. Welcome, friend.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here and excited to catch up. It's been a minute since
it has. The show. We were just talking. It's been a couple years since you've been on the show. We actually got to run into each other at Baltimore Comic Con. Well, that's probably been like 2 years too. So it's been a while since we've talked.
Well, I'm so excited to catch up. Definitely a lot has happened in the last 2 years. And excited to talk all about it.
Yeah. Well, so since it's been a while since we've had you on the show, people haven't maybe gotten to know who you are or how you got into comics. What was your start of getting into comics then?
Yeah. Well, as far as reading is concerned, I'm a third generation comics fan. My mother read comics growing up. My grandfather was a comics fan. And so I think I came by it, honestly, my parents gave me an issue of Amazing Spider-Man, I believe it was 346, when I was a kid. It was Spider-Man fighting Venom, right before they wound up on the island together. And, that really kind of blew my mind. And then they gave me a few other Marvel books, but it wasn't until Infinity War number 2 that I realized they all knew each other. And I was sunk. I've been kind of working my way around the comics industry for about 15 years. I got my start as a DC Comics intern. I worked on Final Crisis and Batman RIP. I worked in comics journalism for about a decade. I was the reviews editor over at Newsarama. And after a while, I just, I felt like I needed to make a change. I wasn't responding to a lot of the things that I was reading. And so I felt like I either needed to kind of step away and be a civilian again, or I needed to take the plunge and put my money where my mouth is and make the kinds of comics that I would want to read. And that led me to writing my first book, Spencer and Locke. And people seem to really respond to that book. And so I've been working, writing comics ever since.
It is. I love that book. Like it sounds so bad, like, because I love all your other stuff, but it is still my favorite stuff.
Thank you.
Like, it's so good.
That book, it was very personal. It took a lot out of me to write. But I love that book. It's my baby. We hope to do a volume 3 one of these days. There are a few outside circumstances kind of keeping us from doing that, but we hope those will resolve themselves soon. Yep. George Santiago Jr. and I can get right back to it, because we're both itching to finish up this saga.
Yeah. Oh, it's, again, I feel like every time I have you on, I have to be like, mention it briefly at least, and then say like,
sure,
tell me we're still getting volume 3 at some point, hopefully down the road.
Yeah.
It is so good. And I highly recommend.
That's the intention. Yeah. At least. So knock on wood, hopefully we will be able to do that sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So I've had, like I said, I've had you on. We talked about Spencer and Locke a lot, the OZ, Scout's Honor, your book with Aftershock, and going to the chapel. Like, you have done so many awesome books when I've had you on, and the 2 years that we haven't talked for a while, you've been doing a lot of stuff. Like, what have you been doing?
I've been very busy. I marked just a little over 2 years over at Marvel Comics, and they've been so good to me. I've loved working over there. I got my start working on Savage Avengers over there, which was just such a thrill of a book. I worked with artist Carlos Magno on it, and I had billed it as a Sword and Sorcery Terminator. It was Conan the Barbarian's final adventure in the Marvel Universe. So we had him being hunted across the Hyborian Age by a Deathlok cyborg from the future. And there happened to be a few misfit toys from the Marvel Universe that kind of got caught in the crossfire. That was super fun. I've worked on digital titles like Avengers Unlimited, which is sort of a brand new digital vertical for Marvel. I was lucky enough to be able to launch that title, as well as do a follow-up story with the Avengers teaming up with the Guardians of the Galaxy on a space casino. I've tagged in on Fantastic Four during the Axe Judgment Day crossover, so I got to write a really fun two-parter that was Die Hard in the Baxter Building, starring the Invisible Woman. I did a really fun one-shot for the Hulk earlier this year. That was a found footage story that was kind of leaning. We sort of passed the baton from Donnie Cates and Ryan Ottley's run to Philip Kennedy Johnson and Nick Klein's amazing run. And now I'm writing a series like Moon Knight City of the Dead, which issue 3 should be coming out sometime in the next few weeks. It's Inception meets Taken. Moon Knight has detached his soul to journey to the City of the Dead to rescue the soul of a young runaway. And he winds up teaming up with the Scarlet Scarab, who you might know from the Disney Plus Moon Knight series. And we recently announced that I'm going to be relaunching Punisher in November with a brand new legacy character. So we're very excited about that. I actually just was looking at a lettering pass of one of our early issues this morning, and I'm very happy with how that's all coming together. And you know, last but not least, you know, I'm still working on the OZ on Kickstarter. We're hoping to do a third Kickstarter for that early 2024. Once we have a good critical mass of artwork, yep. The book's long been written. So we're just kind of taking our time to make sure that the pages don't suffer. And my new Mad Cave original series, The Devil That Wears My Face, it's Face Off meets The Exorcist, about a Vatican exorcist accidentally swapping bodies with a demonically possessed person. And so I'm very excited about that one. That one comes out early October, just in time for the Halloween spooky season. So been busy.
So just a couple books that have come out.
A handful, you know. Sleep's overrated. But yeah, it's been such a wild ride. I could be more grateful. Yeah. I've been working with just such amazing artists and editors, and getting to see to really meet a brand new demographic of readership. People who might not have known my early creator-owned work are getting to rediscover it after reading my Marvel work. Yeah. And I continue to be grateful. It's the best job I've ever had. Yeah. And it's one that the only way I'm going to stop is if if you bury me first. So
how has that been for you? You kind of got your foot in the door of doing a lot of creator owned series first. Sure. And now you you're getting your time at Marvel, and there's not a good thing or a bad thing of, but definitely I think when you're at Marvel, you're going to get exposed. There are people that only will read a DC or a Marvel book because that's comics to them, and not explore indies. But I'm sure that now that people are starting to get familiar with your name, they're probably going back and experience some of your creator-owned stuff that they might have missed. Is that something you're experiencing at cons and things, or?
Yeah, that definitely happens. I've had people who have said, I'm a big fan of what you're doing on Moon Knight. What else do you got? And so it's nice being able to kind of give them the soft sell of Spencer and Locke, or Going to the Chapel, or Scott's Honor, or OZ. It's been really nice. It all kind of feeds back into itself.
Yeah.
In one way or another. And I feel like especially Devil That Wears My Face, I think, has been kind of a cool way of doing that. I just got back from Baltimore Comic Con this weekend, and I was fortunate enough that my booth was actually right next door to the Mad Cave Studios booth. And so they were actually giving a free giveaway of issue 1. And so it was nice to be able to say, hey, you know, if you're really liking what I'm doing on Moon Knight, or if you liked what I did on our Hulk annual, go next door, you can pick up this free new number 1, and then you can bring it back and I'll sign it along with anything else you want to buy. So that's been like a really nice little bit of cross-pollination. For me, it's just, you know, trying to kind of do right by my existing fan base. I've been so fortunate to have such a passionate and vocal following, and it's so nice to see people who have been there since the beginning, who were there picking up Spencer and Locke, who are sitting there picking up Moon Knight, and they're picking up Savage Avengers, and they pre-ordered Punisher. It really means the world to me. I feel like I wouldn't have the success without the village of readers and retailers and press supporting me since day one. And so that's what gets me up every day, is trying to do right by them and trying to justify that that faith. And guarantees that every day I wake up and start swinging big.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Baltimore Comic Con, and when I was there a couple of years ago, it is when you were a Ringo Award winner. OZ.
That was such a wonderful weekend, such a great experience. I couldn't have asked for a bigger win that weekend. I had come off of kind of a rough week personally. My late aunt, she was in hospice for Alzheimer's, very early onset. And so I had spent the better part of that week at home, saying goodbye to her. And at that time, unbeknownst to the rest of the world, that was when I had found out that Marvel wasn't going to be continuing, or the Conan license wasn't going to be continuing at Marvel. And so there was some early discussion of how much we were going to have to reshuffle for Savage Avengers. And that had all happened in the same week. And so I remember feeling particularly fried at that moment of just figuring out, okay, like, what are we going to keep for Savage Avengers? What do we have to change? And so much of that was kind of out of my hands as a first-time Marvel writer, and waiting to kind of hear what was going to happen, how long we would be able to keep Conan. Could we keep him for a full arc? And thankfully we were. And, you know, sort of watching my aunt in her last days, I almost didn't go to that show. And I know it was my mother who said, you've been here for a week. You've said your goodbyes, you know, we don't need you here anymore. And, I remember at the time, you know, they were saying our award category, and I was actually texting my fiance at the time and just saying, well, here it is. There's no way it's going to be us. And then it was, and I feel like I blacked out for a little bit, and I think I said something okay, but the award, the Ringo Award, it was such it was such an amazing experience, particularly for a self-published Kickstarter book. We didn't have the might of a publisher behind us. We didn't have the cachet of a publisher. Nobody really knew who we were for the most part. Ruben Rojas, that was really kind of his first big American work. Whitney Kogar and DC Hopkins were honestly our biggest names as our colorist and letterer. So the fact that that the fans really put us there, and the Ringo judges put us there, it remains a career highlight. That Ringo Award has a place of honor in my living room. The Ringo Awards people were nice enough that we were able to get copies of the awards for the entire creative team.
Oh, nice. So
Ruben and Whitney and Dave all have copies of that award, and I think they deserve it. And very excited to see that saga through to the end. We've got some fun stuff coming.
That's so cool to hear. Like it, you know, the Ringos I think are such a special award because they're fan, you know, voted to get to a stage, and then it's, you know, peers in those other aspects. So like it's almost like a culmination of the best of both worlds, right? Like the fans helping you through the door, and then when you win the award, it's like you know, the peers and the people that are voting are like, yep, acknowledging it.
It meant a lot. You know, I mean, they always say comics will break your heart, but days like that, they'll love you back. it was a real career highlight for me. And something that I still talk about. You know, we even had in the solicit copy for Punisher. You know, it's nice to be able to say Ringo Award winning writer David Pepos, alongside our Eisner and Harvey Award nominated artist Dave Wachter, who's just a real superstar. It means a lot. I guess comics are getting rid of me.
Well, and you mentioned you mentioned some of your colorists and your artists and your letterers, and you know, Justin, who's your letterer on Devil Wears My Face, is a Ringo nominated letter. Like, you surround yourself with people who are super talented too. Like, how do you do, like, not just because you're writing, but like must be probably pretty particular on who you want to work with to make sure it elevates the project.
Very much so. For my creator own work, there's a reason I have a bunch of projects that have not seen the light of day yet. They're sort of slow going in the development stage, or they haven't even found an artist yet, because you have to find the right collaborator. Right. Otherwise the project's just dead on the table. And so I'm very picky about it. And I've been very fortunate that I've waited, because then the artists that I have collaborated with, they are all winners. They're all fantastic. George Santiago Jr., Gavin Guidry, who is just been announced that he's doing one of the Superman 78 miniseries. Ruben Rojas, and now Alex Cormack on Devil That Wears My Face. Those are all artists that I picked. And they are all just really stellar talents. I can't say enough good things about working with them. And and then same thing, you know, honestly, I feel the same way about our colorists. You know, colorists are really the secret weapon of any book. Mm-hmm. And so particularly for my creator-owned work, it usually takes a little while to find the right colorist. Usually I wind up talking to maybe two or three different colorists before we kind of lock in on the one that fits the line art the best.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jason Smith and Liz Kramer and Whitney Kogar especially are all fantastic at what they do. And yeah, so it takes a little while. But yeah, and then, you know, honestly, at Marvel, I've been so fortunate. You know, I've worked primarily with Tom Brevoort, who I see him as like an editorial Jedi master. I can't speak highly enough of him. He's just a genuinely great editor to work with. And sort of amongst the many things that I enjoy about working with him is that Tom is, I think, also very particular about what kind of artist that he puts in a book. And so he's always keeping an eye out for sort of who's the up and coming people, who does he think deserves a shot at the brass ring. And so being able to work with Carlos Magno and Marcelo Ferreira and Dave Wachter and Juan Cabal over on Fantastic Four, you know, those are all Tom's picks. And Fareed Karami over on Avengers Unlimited. So yeah, I mean, it's really, it's nice. You know, it's very nice to be working with an editor that has that kind of seniority, who has been around the block enough times to know kind of instinctively who is a strong artist, who's a good storyteller, who has a lot of energy. And so I really kind of reap the benefits of that in my own work at Marvel. And yeah, it does make us kind of more than the sum of our parts. And so, you know, it's made my Marvel work feel just as exciting of a jam band as my creator own work. These characters, it can sometimes be intimidating to work with these, you know, these very iconic characters. But knowing that I've got the best artists in the business watching my back, it really kind of it makes me feel safe in a way that a more untested artist might not.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about some of your, you know, we talked about all your past projects and stuff that you're working on right now and stuff that you got coming up. But one of the things that, you know, if you read one of your books or even just listening to you talk, you seem to always have this kind of, this is going to be two things combined into one type of story, right? You're picking a Face Off in The Exorcist or, you know, whatever. So for you, is that the same process when it comes to an IP versus creator own stuff of like how you approach something?
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, for me, the moment I started cultivating almost a to-do list creatively.
Okay.
Whether it's a storytelling technique or it's kind of a narrative angle or just like a high concept that like I've seen elsewhere that I'm like, oh, that's really cool. For example, Face Off, you know, with the body swap angle. I was like, okay, I would love to do something with a body swap angle. And I've also known for a while that like I hadn't written anything horror in terms of full length. So that was something that had been on my to-do list for a while. And what winds up happening is, I take that to-do list and I wind up kind of mashing those things together oftentimes. The great thing about licensed work is superheroes, they really do, they lend themselves so well to any genre.
Yeah.
You know, they really, it's sort of the bread of the sandwich, so to speak. You can put any toppings in there that you want to, but you know that like it will still taste good with the superhero. For me, it's always about trying to figure out, you know, tonally, where do these heroes fit? And also just some of it's also writing for your runway. You know, I know, for example, my Fantastic Four story that I had two issues of runway for that. And on top of that, that was pitched to me as part of the Axe Judgment Day storyline. And then for those who haven't read that, basically there's a rogue celestial who is judging humanity over the course of 24 hours. And if humanity as an average passes, Earth is saved. And if we all fail, even, you know, slightly as an average, Earth is toast. And for me, when Tom brought that up to me, I thought, well, you know, giant people eating aliens, that feels like a Fantastic Four problem. But this story isn't called Facts. You know, Fantastic Four are not the lead characters in this. So I approached it as, okay, well, that means they've been sidelined somewhere. And so that is where I turned it sort of into a literal bottle episode, where the Fantastic Four is caught under a force field and it's sort of the various characters are trapped inside over the events of Judgment Day. So you really are, you know, especially when you're writing for a shared universe, you're often thinking of that sort of thing. Or for Moon Knight City of the Dead, for example, or Savage Avengers, for that matter, it's thinking, okay, is there a way for me to sort of sidestep continuity a little bit? So I'm not stepping on anybody else's toes. You know, for Savage Avengers, for example, you know, we had Elektra as Daredevil. And so our story being a time travel story, that worked out very well. So we weren't stepping on anything Chip Zdarsky was doing. Or same thing with City of the Dead, whereas Jed McKay's flagship Moon Knight title is taking place in New York City and dealing with everything going on with Black Spectre right now. We sort of sidestepped and we went to this metaphysical place in the City of the Dead. And that way we don't have to worry about like what's going on, say, in the gang war going on that's going to be coming up in Spider-Man or anything going on with, like, say, Fall of X, for example. These become very standalone and they can cross-pollinate across the Marvel universe, but they're not beholden to anything else going on. Yeah. Which, you know, that often winds up advantageous as a writer, is that you can kind of pick and choose without stepping on anybody else's toes. So it really is kind of a project to project thing. And so you're constantly kind of figuring out, what does this particular project need? How is it going to fit with everybody else? Our new Punisher run is a great example of that, where, you know, we discussed kind of early on, like, how much do we want to cross-pollinate this opening arc with our new Punisher, Joe Garrison? I know we had discussed for at the beginning stages, like, oh, maybe we'd have like Spider-Man or something in the first arc. And I wound up kind of resisting against that because I said, you know, I want Joe's origin story to kind of stand on its own two feet. I want it to be Joe's story, not Joe's story with an assist by Spider-Man. And so that was something that my editors were took into consideration when I was putting everything together. It really, no two projects are the same, which is right. Kind of. But for me, to answer your early question, I'm still trying to take like the high concept elements.
Yep.
I've always wanted to do something like Inception, for example. And so that really informed Moon Knight City of the Dead. Or, you know, I've wanted to do something like a found footage story that had been on my to-do list for ages and I could never think of the right story or the right length. And so when editor Will Moss reached out to me and said, hey, we're doing a Hulk annual, you'd have 25 pages to tell a story. I was like, okay, this feels like a little bit of extra runway. It's a standalone kind of story. We can lean into kind of the experimental tricks of a found footage story. I am constantly thinking about that. I do feel like if I'm not able to kind of figure out a common entertainment vocabulary with my readers to say, oh, you know, if you're a fan of this, I find that it's not quite fully baked.
Because
I want to make sure, listen, I love diehard comics fans. I'm a Wednesday warrior myself, but I'm not here to preach to the choir. My goal is to score converts. And so my goal, anytime I write a book, is to be able to say, oh, you haven't read Moon Knight. Great. Here, take this book. And you'll get a good sense of who he is. And you'll get kind of a cool high octane adventure out of it. So, I think finding that common vocabulary of pop culture, that's really kind of been my guiding principle since I started. And so far it's served me pretty well.
Well, it makes sense because you're speaking a language that people outside the comic world might not know, right? Like you say, oh, you heard of the movie Sin City? Have you heard of Calvin and Hobbes? Well, this is kind of boom, what you get. Have you heard of? And I think it's a more direct way even than to say, what type of comics do you like? Do you like horror? Do you like action?
Right.
You're even going past that. You're saying, what do you like pop culture?
A lot of people don't even, I know because I've tried asking this on occasion and a lot of times people don't know.
Yeah.
Unless you say like, are you a horror fan? That I think we can, is wide enough in the pop culture sphere that you could be a little more broad with that. If you say, oh, you know, are you a fan of crime fiction? It's even with like, you know, the CSIs and the SVUs out there, it's still, at least not that I've seen there, it is not widespread enough amongst the Comic-Con crowd that people would say, oh yeah, I'm a crime fiction fan. You got to be like, hey, you know, and that's why I sort of go the other direction. I'm like, hey, you like Calvin and Hobbes. And that is enough of a cultural touchstone for like a whole generation that they're kind of like, yeah, I like Calvin and Hobbes. Why? When they're a little suspicious. And then I tell them why. And oftentimes it kind of catches them off guard and they laugh and then they read the book. And, you know, I think at first they're simultaneously entertained but horrified. But I think as they read the book, they realize that there's a real emotional through line there. Yeah. So, you know, that really kind of is about that emotional catharsis. And that's what really, that's what's turned so many people into like loyal fans of Spencer and Locke. And same thing with the OZ. And I'm hoping that people will feel the same way about The Devil Wears My Face.
Yeah, well, I want to hit on, you know, Devils Are My Where's My Face and Punisher, because the two series that are coming up. This is one, The Devil Wears My Face, that I got to preview through Mad Cave. And as soon as I read it, put it on my pull list. I mean, you already are on my pull list. If I see a David Pepples book, I'm like, all right, put it on. I instantly went back and looked. And when it was talking to my store owner, I was like, hey, you need to order a couple extra, because he doesn't order a lot of indie books. I'm like, trust me. You need to order a couple. And he goes, all right, I got you. Like, I was like, because I know you'll like it. And I know you're going to have fans that are going to come in eventually, because they're going to. So the idea, we talked about Face Off, Exorcist, you know, what was it like for you? Because it feels like, you know, the last couple of years, you spent a lot of time doing intellectual, you know, licensed property, that you got to kind of dip your toes back into the creator owned world for you. How was that?
Yeah. You know, it's fun. You know, it's so funny, because the way that everything works behind the scenes, some projects move really fast. That's the thing I love most about working at Marvel, is that like the things move fast, because you know, everybody kind of knows how to hit a deadline, and they also know that like they do not want to like foul up an editor's schedule. So they've got like extra incentive to kind of like stick to their deadlines. Whereas creator owned, I've found that like the schedules are often a lot looser. So you know, for me, you know, even though I haven't had anything creator owned come out in a little while, it hasn't been that I haven't been working on it. It's just that the production has, the timeline has been so extended. You know, OZ is a great example where like we've been, you know, Ruben has been just like steadily chiseling away at pages that have long been written. And same thing, even like with my sci-fi book, Grand Theft Astro, that we announced years ago, that we're finally sort of almost at a critical mass for art that like we can maybe like show that to the public soon. Devil That Wears My Face is really no exception. I've actually been working on that since around when I started working on Savage Avengers.
Okay.
And the way that kind of wound up coming together, I'd been talking with Mark London and Chris Fernandez at Mad Cave for a while. They'd been fans of my work, and you know, we'd met up at several conventions. And it was, I think it was New York a couple of years ago, that they were saying, listen, we're really like pushing aggressively to expand Mad Cave. And they were saying, you know, we've got people like Steve Orlando and Chris Sabella joining up. And I respect the hell out of both of them. So I was like, oh, well, you know, like, yeah, we should talk about something. And as we were kind of bouncing ideas off of each other, we all really gravitated towards The Devil That Wears My Face very quickly. You know, just the idea of kind of this like supernatural horror twist on a body swap story, like Face Off, with the cat and mouse elements, sort of, next to the mythology of exorcism. But it was one of those things that we needed to have like the right artist on board. And so, you know, as I was kind of plugging away on scripts, we started talking about like, well, who would be like the right fit for this book? And I was like, what about Alex Cormick? I've been a huge fan of Alex's for some time, ever since his work on Sync over at Comics Tribe. Just really visceral.
That's that was with John Lee's, right?
Yeah, just really visceral, brutal stuff. You know, he's so good at the mood and the visceral elements of it, but also the acting and the choreography. Alex really is like the full package on all of this. And I and Mad Cave was over the moon to work with him. And so I've been friendly with Alex for a few years. I've known him through Rich Duick, who's their upcoming book Drive Like Hell is also coming out in October. So you should pre-order Devil and Drive Like Hell, get yourself a nice Halloween double feature. And so Alex, really, it was just, you know, we had to sort of wait just for Alex's schedule to open up.
Yeah.
And I, you know, both Bad Cave and I were just like, that's worth it. That is worth the wait. And so I think Alex started, it was early this year. I finally got a chance to get cracking on Devil. And in that time, you know, Mad Cave has had a level up in that Mike Martz and Christina Harrington both joined the company. And I've worked with Mike and Christina. They were my editors on Scout's Honor. I've actually known Mike for about 15 years. I actually interned for him back when he was in DC. That was my first industry job when he was editing Batman RIP. So I've known Mike for many years. And Mike said, hey, listen, how about I take over editorial on the book, and me and Christina can kind of tag team this book. And they are fantastic. I mean, honestly, I feel so good about this creative team, you know, between Alex and Mike and Christina. Christina gives incredible notes. She's one of my favorite editors to work with. And Justin Birch, who I've worked with on Die Die Danger Ronin over in the Nightmare Theater horror anthology. Mm-hmm. He and I are actually working on another graphic novel that hasn't been announced yet. We've been working on that for about a year and a half. So I've known Justin, and Alex also knows Justin from their collaborations together. Right. So it's a real slam dunk to get him on the book. And just, yeah, it's really just been a win all the way around. Yeah, it's really just, I'm so proud of how that book's coming together. I don't think I've enjoyed working on a creator-owned project like that since the OZ.
And I,
like I said, I've been wanting to do a horror book for so long. It's sort of been the missing food group for me. I've done crime, I've done sci-fi, I've done fantasy, but I've not done horror. And boy, you know, honestly, the bar is set sky high. I'd love to do more horror after this, just because it was such a fun genre to play in. But I worry that it's going to have to be like conditional on Alex's schedule. He's just such a tremendously talented and gracious collaborator, and you see it on every page. The fact that he's able to juggle multiple projects simultaneously, I tell him all the time, he's like a freak of science. He's certainly unique in this industry. If we had five Alex Cormacs, the industry would be in a fantastic place. We would have a lot more horror books.
What's so funny is when Mad Cave dropped the preview for it in their hub for us reviewers and stuff, I was riding up to Terrificon with Justin at the time, and I'm reading it, and I'm like, I look over at Justin, and I'm like, are Alex and David okay? I was like,
you know, Alex is so funny. He really leans into the horror elements of it all. You know, for me, like, it kind of took a little bit to like be like, okay, it's okay for me to like have a couple decapitations in this book. Meanwhile, Alex is drawing them, and he's sending me like the Austin Powers memes of like, this is how you're not the head of a major corporation. And I'm like, this is the perfect guy for me to work with.
Yeah.
You know, really, I can't say a bad thing about him.
Yeah.
He really is just an artist. He has taken so much investment for this book, even down to, you know, this is a historical book. You know, for those who aren't aware about The Devil That Wears My Face, it's the story of Father Franco Vieri, who's an 18th century exorcist. And he's dealing with a pretty profound crisis of faith. And his superiors send him to Spain to perform an exorcism on a Spanish nobleman's son. And without spoiling too much, the ritual backfires. And so Vieri finds himself trapped in a stranger's body, while Vieri's body has been hijacked by the biblical demon known as Legion, who hightails it back to the Vatican to wreak havoc. And I mean, Alex is really, you know, we have a sword fight, for example, in one of our issues. And as soon as Alex saw it in the script, he was immediately enthusiastic about it. He goes, I'm going to pop in some Errol Flynn tonight to like really like get myself in the right headspace.
Yes.
You know, we have a chase sequence later on in the book, and I immediately apologized, saying, oh, you know, I'm sorry that I'm making you draw horses. He's like, they're just big dogs. You know, like he really, you know, he rolls with everything.
Yeah.
And I can't thank him enough. He's such a talented and gracious collaborator. And so I can't imagine this will be the last time that he and I work together. I'm already kind of thinking, what's the next thing I can pitch for Alex? Because he certainly deserves it.
Love it. I love it. Well, I want to respect your time, but I have to hop into a little bit of what can you tell us about Punisher? Because I know that was a big news that's come out recently.
Yeah. So Punisher, our new Punisher run starts in November, and we're starting with kind of an origin story for our brand new Punisher. It's a new legacy hero. His name is Joe Garrison. He's a former S.H.I.E.L.D. Wetworks agent who had retired to pursue the call of family. He had been known as the Gravedigger of S.H.I.E.L.D. Unfortunately, somebody just blew up Joe's house with his family still inside of it. And the authorities, not knowing his record, because it has been so thoroughly redacted since his retirement, they think we can't find the husband did it. And so I've billed it as John Wick meets the Fugitive, that Joe is sort of trying to find answers as to who set him up, who killed his family, and why. And the really fun thing about this arc is it's very much, we've had a lot of people ask questions of like, well, why would somebody, you know, call themselves the Punisher? Why would somebody embrace that mantle? And that's actually, I think, the through line of our opening arc is it's very much about some legacies you kind of take for yourself, other legacies choose you. And so much of this story is going to be about how Joe's mission evolves and morphs and mutates from being this standalone mission of revenge to something a little bit more open-ended. It's something a little bit more widespread. You know, it was such a fun challenge to work on something like this. I mean, legacy characters in general often come with a polarized response. And I think that's because so often, you know, as a comics fan, and I feel the same way, I've been like this before, you know, we're often reading the tea leaves of solicit copy or, you know, offhand statements on Twitter. And I think we've kind of trained a whole generation of readers to try to anticipate stories rather than necessarily be present and surprised by them. And I understand, you know, like everybody's sort of rolling the dice with their money every month to see, you know, is this something I might like? And a legacy character kind of blows that wide open because you don't know what elements are going to be kept and where you might zig, where a classic character might have zagged. And I always find it to be very additive. You know, for example, Danny Ketch was kind of our big inspiration point.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Danny Ketch doesn't take anything away from Johnny Blaze. So for me, it was, how do we tell a story that, you know, still feels like the Punisher? You know, what qualities do you need to be a Punisher? And, you know, I would say the grittiness, the badass attitude, the sometimes ruthlessness, the self-sacrifice, the willingness to take a hit if it means to take the other guy out. You know, the skill with weaponry,
right?
You know, the arsenal. These are all things that you need to have for a Punisher. But, you know, something I talked a lot about with Tom Brevoort, our editor, about it. You know, I looked to somebody like Robbie Reyes, who Ghost Rider for many, many years was all about motorcycle culture. And Robbie kind of did a little bit of a pivot into muscle car culture. And I thought, how do we do something like that with the Punisher? And the way that I wound up kind of settling in on it was through John Wick. Where it's all about, you know, Joe is really, he's our gun-fu Punisher, that it's just as much about the choreography as it is whatever weapons he's using in any particular moment, as well as really kind of improvising using his environment. So half the fun should be, you can drop Joe anywhere. You can drop him in a restaurant, in an office building, in a zoo, in an airport, and Joe's going to use the environment as well as his arsenal to kind of fight his way out of it. So I know Dave Wachter and I, you know, we talked a lot about, say, classic Scott McDaniel Nightwing or Damian Scott Batgirl to kind of really establish our own visual vocabulary for Joe Garrison. And so it's something that it's a different kind of Punisher for the year 2023. But it's also, we kind of wiped the slate clean a little bit. We're able to really approach with some very blue sky thinking of just, where can we take this new Punisher? And I think the biggest thing character-wise that's so different between Joe and somebody like Frank Castle, beyond sort of taking a little bit more of an elevated approach, you know, with his background in S.H.I.E.L.D., with sort of the more elevated weaponry, which kind of gives us interesting opportunities beyond just standard guns and ammo. And we'll be seeing that as early as the first issue. But it's also that when you first see the Punisher in Amazing Spider-Man 129, when you see Frank Castle, he's already the Punisher. He's already made this decision. He's marinated in this for a while. And sort of whatever kind of family man he used to be, like, that's long in the rear window. Whereas Joe, when we're meeting him, this is all very fresh. And that is, I think, a really interesting headspace to follow Punisher is, you know, without spoiling too much, you know, does he even see himself that way? And just so much of this opening arc is going to be about how his perspective on things is going to change and evolve. Yeah. And sort of watching him kind of embrace becoming the Punisher. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Batman Beyond in a way of sort of a philosophical passing of the baton. And I can't say enough great things about Dave Wachter's artwork on this. Dan Brown also just recently joined up with us for our colors, and he is just spectacular. I can't say enough good things about his work. He and Dave play together really nicely. But Dave, boy, you know, you might know him from his work on Planet of the Apes. He did an issue of Spider-Man 2099 Exodus. He did an issue of Ghost Rider, I believe. This is his best work by far. It's really good. You know, this is a guy who knows all of his best angles. He's very ambitious with the way that he's handling all the fight choreography in this, and the way that he's breaking up his panel layouts to suit that. You know, lots of fun strobe effects, lots of fun kind of breaking up panels with little insets. You know, it's really just incredible, superlative work. And so I just, Dave just turned in another issue of Inks yesterday, actually. And they are just, I mean, the fact that he's able to kind of move at the speed that he does and at the quality that he does. Dave Wachter deserves to be a household name. And I'm just excited. I'm just grateful to be riding his coattails for this Punisher book. But like I was alluding to earlier, you know, this is, of course, this kind of book, you know, you're very much, you're juggling dynamite, you know, and having somebody as talented and rock solid as Dave Wachter as my collaborator on this book, this makes this book feel, it's really encouraging to me. Yeah. And it really is inspired me to bring my A game to it, because I know that like Dave's going to draw the hell out of it.
Well, I'm so excited to see where you're going with all your books that you're working on, you're writing on. David, it's been a blast talking to you. I hesitate to even ask, is there anything else that you haven't gotten to talk about that you're working on that you can?
Yeah. Well, you know, Moon Knight City of the Dead is still coming out. Issue 3 is going to be coming out in a few weeks. I believe issue 5 might still be in pre-orders. So call your local comic shop. You know, maybe they can still add it to your pull list, even if the final order cutoff has passed. But that's been such a fun book. You know, I've wanted to write Moon Knight since I started at Marvel. I tried putting him on the Savage Avengers, not once, but twice. And I had to cut him both times, just for space purposes. Yeah. And so, I had told my editor, Tom, that I was like, well, if we ever get the opportunity for me to play with Moon Knight, you know, count me in. And Tom was kind enough to bring me in for Moon Knight, Black, White, and Blood. I did a really fun story with Leonardo Romero in the second issue on that. And that kind of turned into this miniseries. And, you know, honestly, Marvel gave me all the runway I wanted on this one. They just said, 5 issues with Moon Knight, got any ideas? And my first thought was, can we bring in Scarlet Scarab? They said, sure, absolutely, why not? And then I said, you know, Mark Spector, for those who aren't aware of the character, you know, he was a mercenary who he caught the wrong bullet, and he was brought back by the Egyptian god Khonshu to serve as his avatar on Earth. And so ever since, you know, Mark has kind of treated that as a second chance, and he has gone out, beating up the deserving and taking a few hits along the way. And I remember watching the movie Man on Fire and thinking, oh, that's Mark Spector, Denzel Washington's character in that. Just this guy who is kind of tortured by the things that he's done, and he's trying to make good.
Yeah.
And so this is very much a story. You know, Mark has gone to the mind-bending underworld known as the City of the Dead to rescue the soul of a young runaway. And so we're kind of having this Inception meets Taken kind of story, and Mark is going to be facing, you know, he has had a body count over his years, and so we've confronted Mark with those dead supervillains as the all-new Legion of the Unliving, and yeah, there's going to be a few other semi-familiar faces that Mark is going to be facing over the course of our next three issues, but I've said that this story ultimately is about forgiveness. How hard it is to find forgiveness, especially from yourself. And so I'm very excited for people to read issues 4 and 5, especially. There are some real gut punch moments in those issues that I think all Moon Knight fans are going to want to read.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I've read issue 1 and 2, and I'm like, let's go.
I
So
can't wait for issue 3. I wrote it as an homage to Neo and Trinity's lobby fight in the first Matrix movie. So it's that is kind of the fight comic of the whole
all
miniseries.
right.
That is very much an extended fight scene. Mark versus the Legion of the Unliving, round 2. And it's yeah, it's not gonna go the way the round 1 went. So
All right.
I'm excited for people to check that one out.
Awesome. Well, David, thank you again for hopping
Well,
on,
it's my
talking about comics, and I feel like we could talk forever, because
pleasure.
you have so much and I love so much of your work. So let's do this again sometime soon.
Absolutely, please.
But with that being said, gang, go check out, get your pre-orders in, call your shop to get The Devil That Wears My Face and Punisher and all the backlog of stuff. If you need recommendations, well, hit me up. I'll tell you what to read.
Thank you so
But
much for having me. I really appreciate it.
yeah. And hopefully you can find some time to curl up, grab a book, and nerd out. Peace.